So, we're going to be studying what I called love, lust, and longing in the Talmud. Every class will be on a different Talmudic Agadah that deals with relationships between men and women. There will also be a little bit of halakha connected to the Agadot, but it's basically Agadah. The first one we're going to do is a very famous Agadah called, what's about Rachel and Rabbi Akiva. Rachel was the name of his wife, Rabbi Akiva. And I'll say briefly what I said in the previous class, just said an hour ago, that there's no reason to assume that these agadot, that these Talmudic stories, are necessarily historical. They probably have a kernel of historical truth, which might be 5% or might be 60, 70, 80%. But they're certainly not completely historically true. And I don't say that to take away from him. The opposite is the case. These are very well-crafted stories that are told to teach a lesson, to get across a message. They're about values. They're not about things that happened. They're about things that should happen in our own lives, and it's to give instruction. The rabbis are trying to get across a point, sometimes with the use of halakha, and in our case, we'll see how they do that through the use of agadah. In our story, we'll see that there are inconsistencies in the different versions of the story and inconsistencies with history that make it clear that the story as told is not 100% true, and it's certainly not 100% true historically, but from the rabbi's point of view, it's 100% true ethically, 100% true as far as values and as far as Jewish ideology goes. So, let's read the story through once, and then we'll go back and read it again. It's in the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Tubot, page 62b to 63a. And we'll see, actually we can just flip the page right now, you can see the top of the next page, it says Babylonian Talmud, I mean the back of the page, Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Nedarim, 50a, the same story will appear there with differences. And we're going to compare the two versions of the story. First, we'll begin with the one in the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Ketubot, page 62b. Now, Tractate Ketubot deals with, wouldn't you know it, with Ketubot, with a Ketubah. That is, deals with the relationship between husband and wife as it is constituted in law. And the Ketubah, of course, is the document that sets out the halachic, legal parameters of marriage. And it's quite fitting that the story of the relationship between Rabbi Akiva and his wife is brought in Masechet in Tractate Ketubot. By the way, I'll say one more thing. This is a story that has been taught to generations upon generations of Jewish children, school children, from the age of 5, 6, 7, 8. All of the anthologies of stories for children in Israel have this story. I mean, my kids learned this story when they were 6 years old. But we'll see, there's a lot of depth in this story. You ready? Here we go. From the very beginning, top of the page. Rabbi Akiva was a shepherd of Ben Kalba Savua. The latter's daughter, seeing that he was modest and excellent, said to him, "Were I to be betrothed to you, would you go away to the house of study?" "Yes," he replied. She was then secretly betrothed to him and sent him off. When her father heard what she had done, he drove her from his house and forbade her by a vow to have any benefit from his estate. Rabbi Akiva went and spent 12 years at the house of study. When he returned home, he brought with him 12,000 disciples. While in his hometown, he heard an old man saying to her, to his wife, "How long will you lead the life of a living widowhood?" "If he would listen to me," she replied, "he would spend and study another 12 years. Said Rabbi Akiva to himself, "In that case, I have her permission." And he departed again and spent another 12 years at the house of study. When he finally returned, he brought with him 24,000 disciples. His wife heard of his arrival and went out to meet him, when her neighbors said to her, "Borrow some respectable clothes and put them on." But she replied, "A righteous man is deeply connected to the soul of his animals." That's a verse from Proverbs. On approaching him, she fell upon her face. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Yeah, and kissed his feet. His attendants were about to thrust her aside, at which point Rabbi Akiva cried to them, "Leave her alone, mine and yours are hers." Her father, on hearing that a great man had come to town, said, "I shall go to him, perchance he will invalidate my vow." When he came to him, Rabbi Akiva asked, "Would you have made your vow if you had known that he was a great man?" "Had he known," the other replied, "even one chapter, one single commandment, I would not have made the vow." He then said to him, "I am the man." The other fell upon his face and kissed his feet and also gave him half of his wealth. The daughter of Rabbi Akiva acted in a similar way toward Ben Azai. This is indeed an illustration of the proverb, "You follows you," a daughter's acts like those of her mother.
I'm totally confused.
Totally confused. We're going to go back over it again.
Okay.
In the previous class, I gave introductory explanations while I was reading it the first time. This time I decided to first read it without explanations and then go back and give it. We'll see. Okay, so going back. Here we go.
I understand the first 12 and then another 12 years.
Okay. So, the story means to tell us, at the very beginning, that Rabbi Akiva was not born as a rabbi, not born into a family of scholarship. He was an ignoramus.
He was a shepherd like David.
He was a shepherd like David. He was a shepherd. And he was a shepherd of Ben Kalba Savua. Now, literally, what does Ben Kalba Savua mean? Do you know, Chip, what it means? So Kalba is the feminine of Kelev.
Oh, dog.
Dog. Savua means satisfied. The guy's name was the son of a satisfied dog. Son of a satisfied dog. Now, it's not clear if this person, his name is the son of a satisfied dog, or he is the son of the man whose name was Satisfied Dog. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's not clear. Now, why does it matter? Because Kalba Savua, Satisfied Dog, is the name in the Gemara of one of the most richest men in all of Jerusalem before the destruction of the temple in the year 70. The Talmud said he has enough wheat in his storehouse to feed the whole city of Jerusalem. Now, Kalba Savua lived, again, a very rich man, very, very, very rich man, lived before the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70. Rabbi Akiva, on the other hand, apparently was 80 years old in the year 135. He was 80 years old at the end of the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. Now, if you do your math, it means that 135, go back to the year 70, let's see, 30 and 30 is 65, Rabbi Akiva would be about 15 at the destruction of the temple.
How?
15. He'd be 15 at the destruction of the temple. Right? 15, then add 30, then add another 35. So it's unlikely that he married the daughter of Kalba Savua. That would have him getting married at the age of 13 or 14 or 15. It might be we're talking about the son of Kalba Savua. That son had a daughter. And that would more fit the time of Rabbi Akiva. Note that Rabbi Akiva is called Rabbi Akiva with the rabbi title even at the beginning of the story, even though he was just an ignorant shepherd. So it might be hinting that he has the potential to be who he would become even at the outset. And of course, that potential was seen by the daughter of Ben Kalba Savua. I'm going to read from the first line again. The latter's daughter, seeing that he was modest and excellent, said to him, "Were I to be betrothed to you, would you go away to the house of study?" So she sees this ignorant shepherd, who her father clearly doesn't have too much respect for. He's just a shepherd. He has no money, he has no scholarship, he has no nothing. But she sees in him something that no one else sees. He's modest, which probably means he wasn't loud, he wasn't vulgar, he wasn't like the other uncouth shepherds. He had a certain refinedness to his character, and he was excellent. Now, we don't know what that means, excellent, but she saw in him something. Apparently, since she says, "I want you to go and study Torah," she sees in him the seeds of greatness, of scholarship, of Jewish leadership. She sees in him a future leader of the Jewish people. And she says, "I'll get married to you, I'll get engaged to you, if you agree to go and study, even though, again, he knows nothing at this point. And he agrees to that.
He was, wasn't he even cynical of scholars at the time?
There's a story that says that he was very cynical of scholars.
Yeah.
He said, if a scholar comes by my way, I will bite him like a donkey.
Hmm. Yeah.
And then the
Rabbi Akiva, when he was a shepherd.
Yeah.
And then the Talmud asks, why does Rabbi Akiva say bite him like a donkey? Because when a donkey bites, it breaks bone.
Oh boy.
So it could be Rabbi Akiva was cynical of scholars at one point in his life, if we take that Agadat face value. But let's point out who is the active party in this first paragraph of the story.
The daughter.
She's the active party.
Yeah.
She's the initiator. She's the mover and shaker. She sees potential that certainly her father doesn't see, and even Rabbi Akiva himself didn't see about himself. She sees potential in this man to become a great man. And I don't know if this is love at first sight, but it's certainly not an irrational love. She falls in love with him for his potential, for the greatness that she sees in him. It's a love of virtue, as you would say, and using Greek terms. It's a love of virtue, and she's willing to do something that goes against the grain of accepted practice. She's a daughter of aristocracy. Her father certainly has in mind for her to someday marry one of the sons of the wealthy families of Jerusalem. But no, she marries this ignorant shepherd in her father's eyes, this worthless man, and it's done secretly, of course, so that it won't be discovered. By the way, the word for secretly and the word for modest are the same words. Rabbi Akiva was modest, sanua, and she betrothed herself to him with modesty, in other words, in secret, so that her father wouldn't figure out, wouldn't get to know. And probably her plan, of course, was that they'd get married in secret. No one would know. He'd go to the house to study. He'd come back another few years, and then they'd announce their marriage, and her father would see that he's really a learned man now, so her father would accept him. That was the plan. But it didn't work. Because somehow, I'm reading now the second paragraph, when her father heard what she had done, he drove her from his house and forbade her by a vow to have any benefit from his estate. So she sacrifices everything. She loses everything. And she's now homeless. And Rabbi Akiva, I'm reading the third paragraph, went and spent 12 years at the house of study. And I'm going to stop here for a second, because I'm going to ask a question. I see a certain redundancy in what we just read. A certain problem. Because it says at the end of the first paragraph, and sent him off. See those words? End of the first paragraph. Whereas the beginning of the third paragraph says, Rabbi Akiva went. I'm bothered by that. Why? Because if she sent him off, that means he went. And once she sent him off and he went, then he's there in the house of study. But now it says, Rabbi Akiva went. But I knew that already. Because it already says she sent him off.
Now went, the word. In Hebrew,
it's there. Azil. It's in Aramaic. So
were they betrothed or married?
They were only betrothed. But that's a good question, because what am I going to do now? And how am I going to interpret this story? So let's think carefully. It says, the end of the first paragraph, she sent him off. Then it says, her father heard about what happened, and she was banned from his household. Then it says Rabbi Akiva went. I don't get it. When did he go? Did he go before father discovered or after? It seems to say here both. Mm. He went before. She sent him off. Then her father discovered. But then it says he went. I don't get it. When did he go? Do you understand what's bothering me?
Yeah. I hope he went before.
Did he come back?
Right. From a moral point of view,
yeah.
You said it would think before. Because would he go with her homeless?
Yeah.
He wanted to go when she was still living in the father's house, when she was supported. So look, you could read this straightforwardly, in the sense that he went before the father discovered, as it says, sent him off, end of the first paragraph. Then the father discovered. Then the third paragraph that says Rabbi Akiva went and spent, it means that that's just picking up the story means he had gone. He had went. And now he's 12 years in the house of study. That could be. But, okay, that stays on the table. That's a possible reading that he went before she was discovered. Fine. But if we read it more deeply, it does say Rabbi Akiva went at the beginning of the third paragraph, as if he went after the marriage had been discovered.
It's still a problem, even if he went before, but if he went ahead and spent 12 years there after
right.
he was homeless.
Right, didn't he hear that she had... Good morning. Right. Didn't he hear that she had no way to support herself? Okay, so we have some questions here. Now, let me just think a little bit further about this. Perhaps it really means that he went twice. Going Caroline's direction, perhaps he went, and then when he heard that she had been disowned, he came back. And then for some reason he went again. We'll have to ask why. Or perhaps he never went to begin with. Perhaps she sent him off at the beginning, but he didn't go. And then he only went after she had been disowned.
What did he say was the word for went in Hebrew?
Aramaic, Azil.
Azil. If it had been halach, that would be a difference.
I don't think it makes a difference.
Because he was talking about he was already walking in the way of halacha.
No,
nothing like
not
that.
Not necessarily.
No, I'm sorry.
And if the word is different for sent him off, is different than went, then...
It is different.
So we have a little difference in here.
Sent him off, she is the subject.
Right.
Whereas in the went, he is the subject. So what I just tried to do is to point out that there is room in this story for questions of actually what happened, and we could come up with different theories of the order in which things happened and when they happened. This opens the door to looking at different versions of the story, which we're going to do right now, and see if we can't use another version of the story to add some understanding to this version of the story. So turn the page to the top of the back, where we have the Babylonian Talmud Tractate Nedarim, page 58. It tells the same story differently. Rabbi Akiva was the shepherd of Kalba Savua. The daughter of Kalba Savua betrothed herself to Rabbi Akiva. See, things are missing here. It doesn't say anything about her discovering something about his great potential and qualities. When her father heard thereof, he vowed that she would not to benefit from aught of his property. Then she went and married him. So here it's not just betrothal, and it's marriage. And when did the marriage take place? After
she was kicked out.
She was kicked out. Mm-hmm. And there's no mention of her making a condition of Akiva going to study. And he didn't go to study. No study mentioned. They got married, and they were, of course, dirt poor, because he was a shepherd, and she had no support from parents. In the winter, they slept in a hay barn, and he would pick out the hair from her hay from her hair. So now, let's try and combine the two versions of the story. We could say the following. I can think of two possibilities that I mentioned earlier. What we see from the story in Nedarim, in Tractate Nedarim, is that they certainly were married, they lived together, before he went to study. It's not that he went to study when they were just betrothed. They got married and they lived together. And at the time they lived together, they were dirt poor. Okay, so now let's think. How could we combine the two versions of the story? I'm going to suggest two possibilities. Perhaps, looking at the story in Ketubot, they got married under condition that he goes to study. And she sent him off and he went to study. Then her father kicked her out of the house, and obviously Rabbi Akiva came back to support her. He came back, they got married, they lived in a barn, and then he must have gone again to study, leaving her alone. Or perhaps he never went to begin with. Perhaps there was a condition. When they got married, he'd go, but he didn't go. And can you think, why would he not have gone even if he promised? Well, perhaps because he had no self-confidence, no sense of his own worth, no sense that he could really accomplish anything. He didn't even know the Aleph-Bet. Can he go and study with these great rabbis? Perhaps he made the Kedusha but didn't go, and they got married and lived in the barn for who knows how many years. There is even a story in another version that indicates that at least for 5 years they lived in dirt poverty before he went to study. Let's read that right now. I'm going to go to Avot Rabbi Natan 6:2. It's on the second piece of paper, the first side. Avot Rabbi Natan is a rabbinic work probably from the 5th, 6th, or 7th centuries that is an expansion of Pirkei Avot, an expansion of Ethics of the Fathers. Commentary in addition to Ethics of the Fathers. And it says there, he and his son sat before the teacher of children, the Malamed. Do you see the place?
Mm-hmm.
He said to him, Rabbi, teach me Torah. Rabbi Akiva said to the Malamed, Rabbi Akiva held the slate, held the top of the slate, that's okay. And his son wrote the Aleph Bet at the top of the slate, and he learned it. Now, the son seems to have learned faster than Rabbi Akiva. The son already learned to write it. Rabbi Akiva learned it from his son. Aleph Tetaf, and he learned it. The book of Leviticus, and he learned it. He continued learning to learn the entire 5 books of Moses. According to this, Rabbi Akiva didn't go off to study, rather had children. And he began to study the rudiments only when he brought his son to the Malamed, which means they're married at least 4 or 5 years, and he's still at home. So just let me summarize. So now let's continue reading the story in Nidarim, in the second version. I'm in the second paragraph, in the winter. Do you see the place in the winter? In the winter, they slept in a hay barn, and he would pick out the hay from her hair. And obviously that comes to give a very beautiful image of his concern for her and his love for her, that this poor woman who's used to having 10 servants is now sleeping in a hay barn, and the hay gets in her hair and he has to clean it out. If it were only in my power, said he to her, I would present you with a Jerusalem of gold diadem. That's a very big, nice necklace with a golden Jerusalem hanging from the chain. Elijah came to them in the guise of a man. Remember from the previous class? That a man appearing at the door and cried out at the door, give me some of your hay, for my wife is giving birth and I have nothing for her to lie on. And a poor man comes, can I have some hay? I need something. See, Rabbi Akiva observed to his wife, there is a man who lacks even hay. She counseled him, go and sit in the house of study. Anyone figure out what just went on? What's the connection between the man asking for hay and the wife of Rabbi Akiva telling him to go and sit and study? What's the connection? Okay, some people have less than you.
To raise themselves and to care for her.
Oh, that's interesting what you're saying.
Yeah, and to care for her would be to give her her wishes and let him study and find greatness rather than staying in the hayloft.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I hear what you're saying, absolutely. I hear what you're saying. Any other suggestions? What you didn't pay attention to.
Maybe
she took it as a sign.
Mm-hmm. She sees something in this man.
In the man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think she sees something in Akiva.
Yeah. Say it again.
If Akiva said that even his hay that he's taking out of her hair, that he would even give that to a stranger, that this is a person who should really be studying and cultivating Torah.
Yeah, that's the direction that I'm going in.
Yeah.
In other words, his reaction to the poor man at the door is not a typical reaction. Rabbi Akiva and his wife, Rachel, they have nothing. All they have is hay. And he's willing and able, nevertheless, to understand that other people have even less than him. and he counts his blessings. He's happy. He's satisfied. The implication probably is, when he says there's someone who lacks even hay, that he's willing to give some of his hay to that family, that woman who's in labor. At that point, it's an opportunity for his wife to say to him, you have potential. You have a gentleness of spirit. You have a nobleness of worldview that most people don't have. You have to cultivate that. So, two possibilities.
That he needs to get learning so he can share that.
So he can share, he can develop it and share it, right. And then she says, go sit in the house of study, and he left. So anyway, so that means we have two possibilities, putting the two stories together. They got married with the condition that he would go and study. And either he went in to study, but came back when she got disowned, or he never went to study because he just didn't think himself worthy. In any case, they're living together without him studying. And then with this incident, she urges him, now you have to go. Either she's saying you have to go back or you have to go for the first time. And finally he goes. And it could be that they spent many years together before he went or before he went back, because we saw the story of him beginning to study with his son, which means they were married at least for 4 or 5 years. So it takes a while for him to really begin his 12-year period of study. And at least according to one version of the way we saw it, he doesn't have too much confidence in himself. Why should I be studying? According to the approach they didn't go to begin with, he made a promise, okay. But it's just not realistic. Who am I? But he eventually goes. After the incident with the poor man, and of course the poor man, we understand, must be intended by the author as a messenger from God.
Eliyahu.
Right? That God is giving Rabbi Akiva an opportunity to show his greatness, so to remind himself and his wife that there is potential here, and he has to go and actualize that potential through the study of Torah. So he goes. And according to this version, just understand now, it means that his wife is sending him when he knows and she knows that she will live a life of absolute abject poverty. Because until now, she didn't have her father's wealth, but at least she had her husband. Now she's going to be alone, no father and no husband, no income, not from a husband and not from a father.
Boy, some woman she was a real.
So the story is clearly Shadika. About sacrifice.
Yes.
It's clearly about sacrifice. For what purpose? For the purpose of building up and creating a scholar who's going to be the leader of the Jewish people. By the way, you might find a certain parallel in the relationship between David ben Gurion and his wife Paula.
Hmm.
David ben Gurion became married at a very young age, and he and his wife were deeply in love, and they spent many, many years separated when he was serving the Jewish people. He was on missions to the U.S., missions to Europe. Later, of course, he became prime minister, and he devoted his life to service of the Jewish people. And we have extant the correspondence between husband and wife. And it's very clear that both of them see them sacrificing their individual good for the good of the Jewish people. Another way of saying it, it's not just sacrificing the individual good for the good of the collective, it's also sacrificing the present for the future.
Golda Meir was like that too. She separated. She didn't have much time for her family because she was so busy.
Yeah.
Looking out for the state of Israel.
Yeah.
I mean, in her latter years, I think she sort of felt bad about that because she didn't have a good relationship with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can understand. Yeah. So. Although there's a difference with Golda Meir, it's the individual sacrificing in order to make themselves into a leader of the Jewish people.
Well, that's true.
But here it's the spouse,
yeah,
right, sacrificing.
Different.
It's similar and it's different. It's,
yeah.
There are the spouse sacrificing for the good, not just of the other spouse, but because you see in that spouse the potential to change the world. Right. So it's absolutely about sacrifice for the future and for the collective. So, let's pick up the story. And back in the very first page, the first page, which is the version in the tractate Ketubot, and I'm in paragraph 1, 2, 3. Rabbi Akiva went and spent 12 years at the house of study. Now, we don't know if how much contact there was between him and his wife. It doesn't say. The impression I think the story gives, there was no contact. When he returned home, he brought with him 12,000 disciples. Now, by the way, we clearly notice 12 years, 12,000 disciples, right?
A thousand a year.
These are
That's one of the factors that reminds us this story is a literary creation and not a historical event. Right. No. It's historically, things usually don't work out exactly in a one-to-one correspondence. Mm-hmm. But the author is trying to make it clear the connection between each year, more disciples. Each year of sacrifice, more disciples. While in his hometown, he heard an old man saying to her, "How long will you lead the life of a living widowhood?" In other words, Mrs. Rabbi Akiva, wake up and smell the coffee. You're sacrificing your life for nothing. You're living, you're a widow. What good is there here? I want to show you the version of this on the other side of the piece of paper in Tractate Nedarim. Tractate Nedarim. Going to read in the 1, 2, 3 paragraph. So he left and spent 12 years studying under Rabbi Elias and Rabbi Yeshua. By the way, those are the same two rabbis we saw in the previous class, mm-hmm. Rabbi Elias and Rabbi Yeshua. At the end of this period, he was returning home when from behind the house he heard a wicked man jeering at his wife. "Your father treated you suitably. Firstly, because he's your inferior. You shouldn't marry this good-for-nothing shepherd. And secondly, he has abandoned you to a living widowhood all these years." The reason I wanted to read that is because in this version in Tractate Nedarim, the man who speaks thusly is called a wicked man. In our version, going back to the front page, he's just called an old man. I think the second version makes it clear what the author's intention is. That the person who says, "What are you doing? You're a living widow. It's not worth it. Just forget it. Divorce this guy and go back to marry the man that your father probably has in mind for you." That's a voice that's representative of, let's say, the Yetzer Hara, of the evil incarnation. It's a voice that says, do what's good for you. Don't do what's good for the collective. Do what's good for you and not good for your spouse. Do what's good for you and not good for the Jewish people. Do what's for the here and now and not for the future. Like, that's a voice that many of us are going to hear in our own minds. You don't have to sacrifice so much. It's not worth it. Think of yourself. And she probably hears that voice in her own mind. We all hear that voice. And everyone hears that voice. But what she says in response to that voice, I'm back on the front piece of paper, the first piece of paper, what she says to the voice is, "If he would listen to me," she replied, "he would spend and study another 12 years. In other words, in response to that Yetzer Hara, in response to that urge to just throw in the towel and do what's good for me in the here and now, she strengthens herself and says, "You know what? I'd be willing to give him another 12 years because he needs that to make himself into the great potential I saw when I first met him, and that's going to change the future of the Jewish people."
These great rabbis have wives. Didn't I mean Eliezer? He had a wife.
Yes.
Yeshua, he had a wife, I think. So, I mean, I went with him wherever he's studying for 12 years.
That's a good question. That's a good question.
I mean, she would have had to do... they'd still been destitute, but she could have been maybe around.
I think she would have been a distraction. The fact that she sent him to absorb himself in nothing but learning.
That's a good question. That's a good possible answer. So you could say what we just heard. You could say
they also had livelihoods.
That because Rabbi Akiva was beginning from nothing and had to make up so much time, he had to be without distractions. It had to be the most deepest, most intense study of Torah that you can possibly think of. And were he to be married, not just on paper, but actually married with his wife there, there'd be two types of distractions. There'd be the financial distraction, have to see to her good. And he wouldn't be able to ignore it if she was right there. He'd have to take some time to work. There'd also be the distraction of simply living with someone and going to the movies sometime and talking and getting to know each other and spending time together. And they both decided that that distraction was not to
but
be.
They were impoverished outsiders, whereas the other rabbis, that was their home, other leadership, that they had homes and they had families and they had
professions,
assistants.
Yeah. Although some of them were very, very poverty stricken also. Yeah. Rabbi Yeshua.
She would be uprooted and be with nobody.
But she's uprooted anyway, right?
Yeah.
She's.
Well, what about a mother? There's no word of mother here.
Well, there was. Oh, her mother, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Her mother, but.
Right, no mention of her mother.
She had other. I'm sure relatives and mother, somebody that would
take care of her, help her. We don't know.
Right?
We don't know.
Keep up a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It didn't say they all disowned her.
Right. Right. It's fathers who are known to disown their daughters, not mothers.
This may be far-fetched, but another Rachel from Bereshit, Jacob had to wait 7 years and then another 7 years. And so even though this is 12 years, in this case, the tables are turned.
But Chip's right. The author of the story seems to have another Rachel in mind. Right? And there is absolutely, in this story, like in the other story, delayed fulfillment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Distance.
But
waiting.
Actually, as children, we learn that Rabbi Akiva, pretty interesting concept that you presented.
Perhaps.
And it was only at 40 that he was mature enough and strong enough in his convictions to follow.
Yeah. Now, of course, remember, we're not necessarily trying to figure out history, because these are stories. But we are trying to figure out what the author wants us to think, what the author wants to teach us, what values the author wants to get across. What scenarios the author wants us to have in mind as we're listening to the story being told again and again and again.
So why is it always the woman that has to sacrifice?
What
about his side of the equation? He goes away for 12 years, he studies, he's got all these disciples, and because he hears her say, I give him another 12 years, he goes off.
That's a very good point. I would say two things, and actually a little bit intention of two things I'll say. One is, well, first of all, it's not just her that's sacrificing. He's also sacrificing, right? He's leaving his wife. He's leaving the possibility of a family life with all the fulfillment and the warmth that there would be in living with the woman he loves. He's absolutely sacrificing. But on the other hand, you're clearly right that her sacrifice is of a different type, of a deeper type. He's going to get the acclaim. He's going to be Rabbi Akiva. She's not going to get that. She's putting him through graduate school and through a postdoctorate. And he's the one that's becoming that. So that's clearly one of the messages of this story. And this is a matter that probably divides between our culture. I'm not sure about this, certainly divides between postmodern culture and rabbinic culture. In the rabbinic culture, the woman may be the mover and shaker. She may be the initiator, but she's always the one behind the scenes. She's always the one sacrificing, and the story is meant to teach women to sacrifice for their husbands. That's absolutely true. Now,
that was true when I grew up, too. I mean, I know a lot of women that put their husbands through school.
Absolutely.
Worked,
absolutely.
While they became doctors and lawyers.
Right.
And
there's also a matter of different satisfaction. So it's like a person who can't write edits.
Say it again?
A person who can't write edits.
Mm-hmm.
So there is creation, which is natural to women, that actually not needing acclaim, but needing that self-fulfillment of knowing that you are creating something larger than yourself that will be lasting. You don't need your name on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's...
Right, that's clearly the ideology behind the story.
Yeah,
that the woman is the power behind the throne. The woman is the enabler with great initiative, with great insight, with great resourcefulness, with a sacrifice, but she's not the one that ultimately has her name up in lights. So, look, obviously, in the postmodern world, you can disagree. You can you might have a different set of values.
So if she was disowned and had nothing...
How did she survive? In answer to that question, look at a story, a short story, at the top of the second piece of paper. It says, Talmud, the Land of Israel, Tractate Shabbat, 6, 7, Chapter 6, Halacha 7. A tailor, Rabbi Akiva, who made his wife a city of gold diadem, right? When he eventually came back, we'll see later, and he became very rich, he made his wife this beautiful pendant. The patriarch, Rabban Gamliel's wife, we learned about Rabban Gamliel and his wife in the previous class, became angry and jealous of her, of Rabbi Akiva's wife. She came and told her husband, why didn't you buy me what Rabbi Akiva bought for his wife? He said to her, would you have done for me what she had done, selling her hair and giving him the proceeds that he might study Torah? Can you imagine a very, very beautiful, luxurious hair, cutting it off every 3 years and selling it for apparently a great price? And that was one of the ways, according to this story, again, it's not history, one of the stories in which, one of the ways in which she made a living to support her husband. Now, did she literally, how do they say in English, the shirt off my back?
Yeah.
The hair off her head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to the story. Back to the very first page. I am perplexed at the matter of him coming back after 12 years, hearing his wife, overhearing his wife say he could go another 12, and him going. According to the story, we're supposed to understand he didn't even say hello to her. That's difficult, right? That's difficult. I can imagine perhaps there's a sense that if he had said hello and spent a few days, there's a temptation that they might have turned into a few weeks, into a few months, into a few years. Perhaps we're supposed to get a sense of great, great restraint on his part. He's able to withhold his urge to come and say hello and embrace and talk and get to know her. Withholds himself from that and goes to study, not because it's easy, but because he knows that that's what she wants.
But he traveled with an army of disciples. There had to be a lot of dust. He couldn't just sneak in and out.
That's a good point. That's a good point. That's a very good point. Notice in the version in Nidarim, it doesn't say came with disciples. In the version in Nidarim...
Excuse me.
But Mimi made a very good point. I thought about that myself. In the version in Nidarim, it says in paragraph 1, 2, 3... So he left and spent 12 years studying on Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yeshua. At the end of his period, he was returning when in from the man, how that man came. It doesn't say he had disciples.
Okay.
But you're right. In our version, on a top piece of paper, it says he came with 12,000 disciples, but he wasn't noticed. You're right. That's not... doesn't seem to fit. And again, that makes it clear this is not a historically accurate tale.
Well, did he really come with them, or is there some linguistic trick?
I think they were with him in spirit.
Yeah,
I understand.
That he
okay.
had already.
It says he brought accrued, with him.
Accrued.
I don't know. So anyway, we're now reading on the first piece of paper, the very top. The first piece of paper where we left off, paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4. When he finally returned, he brought with him 24,000 disciples. By the way, there are 24 books of the Bible, right? There are 12 tribes. All these numbers are symbolic.
Also, how many people, all men, did Esau come, meaning Jacob? Was it 1,200 men? I forget the figure.
It's 600.
600 men?
Okay. Yeah. 600 is half of 12.
That's true.
12,000. His wife heard of his arrival and went out to meet him. When her neighbors said to her, borrow some respectable clothes and put them on. But she replied, a righteous man is deeply connected to the soul of his animals. Verse from Proverbs. Now, we have to understand the use of that verse. Some interpreters say this is actually the high point of the story. On the one hand, we might be very put off by her use of the verse. What is she, an animal? She's comparing herself to an animal. But there's something more to it.
The clothes were made of animal skins.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, they're also clothes made of...
That's true, that's true.
...of other things.
That's true.
Linen.
That's true.
Think of it like this. Rabbi Akiva is a shepherd. The foundations of the Jewish people are in a pastoral society. Think of the relationship between a shepherd and his flock. Think, if anyone remembers, of the Midrashim about Moshe, how he takes care of the sick and of the weak and of the young of his flock. He loves them. He is deeply connected to his flock. Remember, the shepherd doesn't slaughter them for meat. He keeps them for milk and for fleece.
And David,
David was a shepherd. When she uses the verse, a righteous man is deeply connected to the soul of his animals, she's trying to say that he loves me. He knows me. He's bonded with me like a shepherd is bonded with his flock. He takes care of me. He knows my needs. And I look at him as my protector. Even though they've been away for 24 years, he's been away for 24 years, she trusts that she is still to be shepherded by him. By the way, just another thought, linguistically, the word in English, husband, you know, everyone's heard of the profession of animal husbandry. What is a husband? A husband is a shepherd. Now, I understand this is not politically correct in the 21st century, right? But in traditional thought, and it's been this way until 20 years ago, right? The husband is the husband. The husband is the shepherd. Now, until now, her name has not been mentioned, but I've been calling her Rachel. A Rachel is a baby lamb. Mm-hmm. That's what the word means in Hebrew. E-W-E. Ew? Mm-hmm. Right? So when she uses this verse, she's saying, I am the Rachel, I am the baby sheep, and he is my protector. And it's, there's a little bit of self-effacement here. They're not equals, right? But she's not demeaning herself, the opposite. She says, I am connected to a shepherd who is a great man. And even though 24 years have passed, he's not going to forget me. Now, just to give an idea of the power of the metaphor of the relationship of the shepherd to the ewe, I want to read a story from the Bible that you probably all heard. The bottom of the second piece of paper, the bottom of the first side of the second piece of paper, second book of Shmuel, chapter 12. You remember the matter of King David and Bathsheba? Mm-hmm. How he killed the husband of Bathsheba and took her to wife? And then the prophet Nathan comes to David to rebuke him. So this is what the prophet David said, the prophet Nathan said. The Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man, prepared it for the one who had come to him. That's the parable that the prophet told David. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, as surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die.
Because he was talking to David at the time. David was the man.
Right. Of course, the rest of the story is David. The prophet says, Atahaish, you're the man.
Yeah, right.
But for our purposes, I just wanted to bring us to show the depth of the emotional connection between the man and his little lamb. Right? And that has to be in our minds when Rachel says concerning her relationship to her husband, right, that I am like his lamb. There's nothing demeaning there. It's actually a very, very powerful metaphor. Now, I can further mention that there are a number of times in the Tanakh in which the relationship of the Jewish people to God is compared to the relationship between a lamb and the shepherd. And also in the Song of Songs, which is understood to be a metaphor for the relationship between God and the Jewish people, there's that same idea of the shepherd and the lamb. Okay. I'm going back to the first piece of paper. In paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4. Right after the verse from Proverbs. On approaching him, she fell upon her face and kissed his feet. His attendants were about to thrust her aside, at which point Rabbi Akiva cried out to them, "Leave her alone, mine and yours are hers." And that is a very powerful statement. And all the study that I've done for 24 years, and all of the students I've taught, and all the Torah that I know and that you know, he says to his students, it all really is in her merit. It really all belongs to her. She deserves just as much credit as I do, and perhaps even more. Because remember, not only did she allow me to study for 24 years, she didn't just allow me, she initiated the idea. She's the one that filled out the applications to medical school. Right?
Pushed him in that direction.
She pushed him in that direction. It's all in her merit. And the students, of course, are told that by their teacher. That's one of the messages that he's teaching them. I want to compare it again to the version in Nedarim on the back of the same page, where it says, no, I'm sorry, not there, but the place I wanted to go is, right, I wanted to go to the third piece of paper. The second piece of paper is the back. The back of the second piece of paper says at the top of Avot Rabbi Natan 6:2. One day when Rabbi Akiva's situation had improved and he made his wife shoes of gold and a city of gold diadem, his students said to him, "Rabbi, you have shamed us by what you have done." Rabbi Akiva said to them, "She had suffered a great deal with me in the Torah." So just notice the depth of connection between the teacher and the students. They're involved in his life, not just in the classroom, but they know what he buys for his wife. They identify with their teacher such that they feel ashamed when it looks like he did something improper, that he went and splurged and spent so much money on jewelry. What's so important about jewelry? And he teaches them a lesson. She has suffered a great deal with me in the Torah. Or she sacrificed. She deserves it. The students didn't understand, according to this, the depth of gratitude that's owed to her, to Rachel. And that's one of the things that he teaches his students. Okay, let's go back to finish the story, yeah? At the bottom paragraph of the very first page, at the top. The bottom paragraph of the very first page at the top. Her father, on hearing that a great man had come to town, and he doesn't know that this is his son-in-law, said, "I shall go to him for a chance to invalidate my vow."
What does that mean?
It means, so we have a structure in halakha, that if you vow to do something, that vow, or not to do something, that can be invalidated through a certain halachic procedure. What goes on is that in front of a court of three, and if it's an expert judge, it can be done in front of a court of one, if circumstances developed that were completely unforeseen at the time of the vow can be annulled. In other words, let's say I vowed to give $1 million when I was a millionaire, and then I lost all my money. So the court could say, you vowed to give the money under condition that you're a millionaire, but you didn't foresee not becoming a millionaire, and now you don't have the money. You just can't do it. It's impossible. The vow doesn't apply anymore because the conditions under which it were made no longer apply. So Kalba Savua, even before he knows that Rabbi Akiva has become a great man, wants to have his vow annulled, because he probably has developed a certain degree of empathy for his poor daughter, and he wants to give her some money. 24 years have passed. He's become a little bit more mellow. And he goes to Rabbi Akiva, not knowing as Rabbi Akiva, his son-in-law, but thinking it's a great scholar. Let me ask him if he can validate my vow. And Rabbi Akiva says, would you have made your vow, on the bottom of the very first page, would you have made your vow if you had known that he was going to become a great man? Had he known, the other replied, even one chapter, even one single commandment, I would not have made the vow. I made it because he was absolute and exact now.
I'm Haaretz.
I made the vow because this Akiva guy was an absolute ignoramus. He then said to him, Rabbi Akiva said to the Kalba Savua, I am the man.
And he said, Nathan, you are the man.
You hear that? You see the connection here? That's beautiful. Right? When he says, I am the man, we should all remember the story of King David and Nathan. And that connects us with the sheep shepherd relationship. Very good. The other fell on his face and kissed his feet and also gave him half of his wealth. So Kalba Savua had his vow now annulled, and he decides not only to give his daughter some money, but half of his wealth. The daughter Rabbi Akiva acted in a similar way towards Ben Azai. In other words, Rabbi Akiva's daughter apparently had not just a son like we saw earlier, but also a daughter. Did the same thing. She married a potential scholar and allowed him to study also. This is indeed an illustration of the proverb, "Ew follows ew." A daughter's acts are like those of her mother. So that's the story. It's a very powerful story that tries to teach some very, very central values for the culture in which it's found. It's about self-sacrifice. It's about specifically women as enablers. In the story, Rachel, she's the woman of foresight. She's the one who initiates. She's the one in charge. She's the one who makes all the decisions. But all of that's behind the scenes. And all of that is for a greater good that's beyond her. And it's only because her husband gives her credit in the presence of his students that does anyone know who she is. She's
really a tzaddika.
She's a tzaddiket. She's a woman of modesty and power who's not to be in the limelight. I just want to show you at the end that the Talmud actually says this explicitly in a statement of values. The backside of the second to last sheet. There's only three sheets, so it's the second sheet. And it says there in the Babylonian Talmud tractate Brachot, page 17b, our rabbis taught, greater is the promise made by the Holy One, blessed be He, to the women than to the men. For it says, rise up, ye women that are at ease, ye confident daughters, give ear unto my speech. And this verse doesn't say what the rabbis say it says, but they find a hint in the matter of the great merit of women by the prophet calling them confident daughters. But that's not our subject. The subject is what the rabbis do with the verse, and that's what I'm going to read now. Rav said to Rav Chiya, whereby do women earn merit? By encouraging their children to go to the synagogue to learn scripture, and their husbands to the house of study to learn Mishnah, and waiting for their husbands till they return from the house of study. That's the classic, what postmodernists call chauvinistic statement of women as enablers, as providers behind the scenes, but not as actual women of direct accomplishment. I understand that's culturally debated. You can take that as you want. But going beyond the specific task of women that the story that we learn wants inculcate in us, there's the idea of self-sacrifice for Torah, self-sacrifice for study. And perhaps I should add one more thing before we close about that. Notice that Kalba Savua, the great rich man, of course he wants the best for his daughter, and when she marries this ignoramus, she is disinherited. Why is she disinherited? Not because Akiba is a poor man, but because he's ignorant.
Yeah.
Look at the values that we're supposed to understand. That even Kalba Savua, who's not a very, very positive character in the story, he understands that scholarship is worth just as much as wealth, if not more. And he'd be willing to have his daughter marry a poor man as long as he was a scholar. When Rabbi Akiva comes back after 24 years and he agrees to the marriage, it's not because Rabbi Akiva became rich. It's because he became learned.
Learned.
So here you see the central importance of scholarship. Right, in the Jewish world, and it's not just today in the 20th century, it's 2,000 years ago. Scholarship is even more important than wealth. Sometimes scholarship and wealth are at odds. But the story doesn't tell you that if you want to be a scholar, you have to be poor. It says at a certain point, there was no choice but to be poor. But ultimately, Rabbi Akiva becomes wealthy. He's given half of the inheritance, half of the wealth of his father-in-law. So the message is not that you have to be poor to be a scholar. They go together. They can go together, wealth and scholarship. But you have to be willing to sacrifice.
Was there a tuition that the yeshivas were rabbi?
That's a good question. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. We have the story of Hillel that tells that there was a tuition. Right.
But rabbi, you said he would have to have a scholarship to be a rabbi.
Well, it's interesting. The story in which we read she sold her hair doesn't say that she used the proceeds to support herself. It says to support him. So it might be that there was, at the beginning, a certain tuition that had to be paid.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very
That's
much.
That's our story.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Dallas back again. Appreciate it. We're glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here because I love teaching.